Welcome to the Filmtrepreneur Podcast, episode number 17. The Dean of the American Film Institute has written that I am one of the very few auteurs left in America. I have freedom for 40 years to create art that is totally personal and is what I believe in. Lloyd Kaufman.
This is the Filmtrepreneur Podcast, where we teach you the top strategies, tactics, and growth hacks that every indie filmmaker needs to know to make money with their films. We are the podcast that puts the business back into show business. And here's your host, Alex Ferrari.
Welcome, welcome to another episode of the Filmtrepreneur Podcast. I am your humble host, Alex Ferrari. Today's show is sponsored by Black Box. Now, guys, as filmtrepreneurs, we're always looking for a little bit of side cash, a little bit of extra revenue streams, and Black Box does that in spades. What they do is allows you to sell your stock footage, you know, footage that's sitting around in your hard drive from old shoots or stuff that you're actually creating for the stock footage market, but it allows you to submit to all the stock footage platforms at once. It handles all the technical submitting and also payments, so you can get all your payments out of one platform as opposed to going to all these other places and signing up everywhere. It does it all for you. I've created a really, really nice revenue stream from Black Box, and it is a passive revenue stream, which is amazing. So if you want to check it out, head over to blackbox.global to find out more. Today's show is also sponsored by the Make Your Movie Bootcamp. You want to make a feature film, but you have no idea where to get started. I feel you because that's exactly where I was years ago when I first got started. But I finally decided to stop talking about making a movie and go out and just do it. I want to help filmmakers break through their own fears and show them the secret sauce on how to make a profitable feature film. So I decided to put together the Make Your Movie Bootcamp and condense all 25 years of my experience into a two-day intensive. And in the camp, I cover how to flesh out your idea, the screenwriting process, finding money, crowdfunding, directing your film, post-production workflows, marketing, submitting to film festivals, film deliverables, self-distribution secrets, and how not to get ripped off by predatory film distributors. And I'll also have two special guests from the film industry talking about how to find money and distribution. This bootcamp will be held in Burbank, California on October 26th and 27th at the Hilton Garden Inn in downtown Burbank. If you want to get 20% off the bootcamp, just head over to mymbootcamp.com. That's Make Your Movie or mymbootcamp.com. Now, today on the show, guys, I have a big treat for you. We have the legendary Lloyd Kaufman of Troma Films. He is one of the original filmtrepreneurs. He has been able to build out not only ancillary product lines, not only multiple revenue streams, he's been able to do it all on his own using his unique brand of filmmaking. He's been around since the early 70s, late 60s. And his films are legendary. Titles like The Toxic Avenger, Class of Nukem High, Tromeo and Juliet, Troma's War, Poultrygeist, Night of the Chicken Dead, and many, many more. And also many big filmmakers got their start in Troma Films, like little guys like James Gunn, the director of Guardians of the Galaxy, as well as Trey Parker and Matt Stone, the creators of South Park. This guy is an absolute walking, living legend, and I was honored to talk to him. So we get into everything Troma, how he was able to build out his empire, and some other unique off-color topics, to say the least. So without any further ado, please enjoy my conversation with Lloyd Kaufman. I want to welcome to the show Lloyd Kaufman from the legendary Troma Pictures. Lloyd, thanks again for being on the show. We really appreciate you taking out the time.
Hey, I'm the Indie Film Hustle is Troma's favorite podcast. So you're a hero in Tromaville. You're a champion of the independent artists. I heard your podcast with Rodriguez. It was very, very, very good.
Thank you so much. I appreciate that. So, Lloyd, I know a lot of people in the audience might not know who you are and how you got into the business. So can you tell us a little bit about how you got into the business?
Well, Alex, I made the mistake of going to Yale University. Mm-hmm. It was the 60s. I was going to be a teacher or a social worker and make the world a better place. Teach people with hooks for hands how to finger paint. Teach mm-hmm. bums how to paint happy faces on beads and string the beads together. Right. All that kind of stuff. But I was placed by God in a room with a movie nut.
Mm-hmm.
And God fucked up my life. our beds were head to toe. At night, I'd inhale my roommate's Godard stinking feet.
Mm-hmm.
Next thing I know, I start drifting into the Yale Film Society screenings.
Mm-hmm.
They were all auteurists. They had the office of the Film Society at Yale had a big stack of cinema, of a Cahiers du Cinéma, the literally notebooks of cinema, but there was the magazine of the Cinémathèque Française. I speak French and read it, so mm-hmm. I started reading those things, and I bought into the auteur theory of filmmaking. Those articles in those days mm-hmm. were written by people like Chabrol and Godard mm-hmm. and Truffaut, who were just starting to kind of phase from journalism into movies.
Right.
And I bought into it, that the director must be the author of the movie, must be in total control, must kind of be the dictator of the film.
Mm-hmm.
And then one day I happened to drift in to see a movie called To Be or Not to Be, mm-hmm. Directed by Ernst Lubitsch, starring Carol Lombard and Robert Stack and Jack Benny. And it was during that – in fact, I was trolling actually for some boys to fuck, and I was just knocked out by what – there were only about three people in the room that night, a big auditorium, and I was so knocked out by To Be or Not to Be by Ernst Lubitsch. It was so crazy and yet so disciplined, so funny but yet touching, so serious but yet slapsticky. I majored in Chinese studies, out of which I gained a big respect for Taoism, mm-hmm. yin and yang, and opposites. You can't have good without evil. You can't have beauty without ugliness.
Right.
You know, that kind of blah, blah.
Uh-huh.
So it was right there in that dark room that I decided during Ernst Lubitsch's To Be or Not to Be that I didn't want to just teach the people with the hooks for hands how to finger paint. I wanted to film them.
Uh-huh.
And so if you want to blame somebody for trauma, go to the graves of Ernst Lubitsch, Robert, what's his name, and Carol Lombard, and urinate on them.
Now, one of your classmates was actually Oliver Stone, correct?
Not only that, but I grew up with him. We were in second grade and spent most of our educational careers in close proximity. His folks and my folks were very tight.
Oh, how cool.
And when I say tight, I mean tight.
Uh-huh.
He and I were in fact, he was by the time we went to Yale, he was writing a crappy novel. He wanted to be James Joyce, and I was making movies with my roommate, and
right.
Oliver kind of hung out, and I am the reason that he went into movies. He helped produce Sugar Cookies, my first 35mm attempt.
Mm-hmm.
Also, he's in Battle of Love's Return, the first Sing Sound movie I made, which was Battle of Love's Return, played in New York a long time ago. It's
mm-hmm.
unwatchable. But Oliver has a small part in it. And it turns out thanks to me, we didn't have to read his shitty novels. He became a brilliant filmmaker, and he's one of our national treasures. He's got so many Oscars. His mantelpiece has to be reinforced. And, of course, he dropped me as soon as he became successful.
Of course,
I don't blame him one bit.
now you've been.
His mother kept in touch, though. His mother would call. His mother and my mother were very tight.
Okay,
they were all. My folks were extremely tight with his folks. Yeah, she just died recently, and I mm-hmm. sent Oliver a note. I hopefully got it.
Oh, that's awesome. Awesome that you sent him the note. Now,
a lovely lady. In fact, I saw that there was a St. James Church in New York. He was having some kind of remembrance for her. And I had to leave on an airplane. But the night before, I stuck a condolence note under the door, and hopefully he got it. And I called the church. They said they delivered it to him.
Now, you were an independent film company before independent film companies were in vogue back in the day with Troma, right? And was it Troma first, or did you have another company before Troma?
We started something called Armor Films that with two older guys who I met when I worked at Canon, the company that
Canon.
But they, this was Cannon before the boys from Tiberius took it over.
Yes, yes.
This was Cannon who made Joe, where I met John G. Avildsen, who was a major influence on my oeuvre, and with whom I am in constant contact. And he's still I'm eating some pumpkin seeds. What a stupid me. Why am I eating pumpkin seeds when I'm talking to Alex Ferrari of Indie Film Hustle? Sorry, I guess it's just nerves.
It's all good.
And I've just come back from Portugal this morning. We're making a movie over there called Mutant Blast, so the jet lag's probably got me
a little loopy.
Yeah, exactly.
So how did you start Trauma?
The Armor Films thing didn't work out. And Michael Herz and his wife had actually Michael's wife happened to go see Cry Uncle, which you can see. It's a Trauma movie directed by John G. Avildsen. I was a partner on it, and Trauma ended up with the distribution rights, but it was produced by Lee Hessel. It's a wonderful film. It's hilarious. It's a satire of the film noir, Cry Uncle, you know, Cry Terror, Cry What Darkness, Cry Cry Uncle. Mm-hmm. And Avildsen directed it. It's hilarious. For some reason, Maris, Michael Herz's wife, took her mother to see this movie in 1970. It was X-rated, 35-millimeter X-rated movie. It had a full-page ad in the Times. It was a big success, but she must have put a thumb over the X rating part. She took her mother there, and lo and behold, she sees my big screen credit. And I had made a movie at Yale which featured Michael and his wife, or they had a cameo in it called The Girl Who Returned. And she remembered, and in fact, Michael Herz went to, he went to camp. They were camp counselors. He was a camp counselor with my brother, summer camp. So when it was, so he had looked me up at Yale because he and my brother were buddies, and I put him and his wife to be Maris in The Girl Who Returned in a cameo, a movie I shot with a Bolex. The Bolex is not a STD; it's a camera, a very fine Swiss camera.
It is.
You can't shoot sync sound with it. What's that?
It was a tank of a camera, boy, back in the day.
Oh, it's wonderful. Okay, yeah. I still have it. I've never had it serviced. I've never touched the. I have a zoom lens on it, a Vario Suitar zoom lens. I've never touched the lens with human hands, or never even cleaned it. I just blow it off with a baby's suction. Enema tube, an enema thing.
Right, yeah, sure.
But I shot The Girl Who Returned, a feature-length movie, whilst I was at Yale, and it's in black and white, it's unwatchable, but Michael and Maris have a very funny clip in it. And anyway, so she had seen my name, and Michael was at law school. She didn't want to, Michael, did not want to be a lawyer, and he contacted me, and we made some. We got involved with Menachem Golan and financed a horrible, horrible movie called Big Gus, What's the Fuss in Israel. It's the worst movie ever made. James Gunn says that it was the worst thing that happened to Western culture since Goebbels or something like that. James Gunn said it was the worst thing that happened to the Jewish people since Hitler or something. Mein Kampf or something like that. And indeed it is. It's awful. And the for your viewers who are listening to this, Alex, the lesson there was that Michael Herz and I, and by the way, Andy Lack, who is another childhood friend of mine, Andy Lack, who is now running NBC TV and also ran Sony Music and he's a big, as they say. The three of us were bamboozled into – all we had to do was put up the money and the Israelis would take care of everything.
Of course.
And boy, did they take care of everything. What a disaster that was.
So
poor Michael Herz, we decided we better do something. We kept getting ripped off. So we decided we would, when it came time to make Squeeze Play, our women's liberation movie, we decided we better learn how to distribute films. And that was in 1974. And indeed, in those days, if you had a movie that was commercially viable, you could get it into movie theaters, and if the budget were really low and the movie was entertaining and commercially acceptable, you could make a few bucks. And we did. From then on, we became so. That's when we started Trauma, when we decided we have to distribute our own movies or we're never going to see any money. It's a crooked, crooked world out there.
Oh, and it's not gotten any better since 1974. If not, it's gotten a little worse as far as the distribution game is concerned.
It's much worse because the rules against monopoly have all been done away with. So you've got the vertically integrated, devil-worshipping in international conglomerates controlling the entire industry from the bottom up. Mm-hmm. So unless you're a partner with one of the vassals of Rupert Murdoch or Viacom or Sony, you can't survive. And the proof of the pudding is where are the – sorry to be use that trite phrase, but – where are the where are the independent movie companies with any longevity? We're the only ones. Lionsgate is doing great. Mm-hmm. That's it, and they haven't been around that long. And they are built on the ashes of Vestron Video and
Artisan, right?
Artisan. Mm-hmm. They're Artisan. and there may be one or two companies that are 15 years old, maybe. Mm-hmm. But it's not that there are hundreds of independent companies that come and go, and it's not that they're making bad movies. Is that they cannot survive in an industry dominated by a cartel.
But now, though, you know,
by cartelism,
absolutely,
it's worldwide. It's a Return to Nukem High, our movie that came out last year in about 300 theaters. It was profitable because it was made in conjunction with one of the vassals of a giant company called Liberty. They're the biggest, or either they or Comcast are the biggest cable conglomerates. And Starz Entertainment or Starz Media, whatever they are, they were our partners. And the young guy who grew up with Troma was in a position to greenlight. It was his idea, really.
Oh, how cool.
But the movie was very low budget, and I had total control. In other words, if I kept the budget around $400,000, they'd give me total control. And we did it, and we made a little money. Poultrygeist, Night of the Chicken Dead, Poultrygeist is is equally as good, maybe better. And my wife and I put up the money for that, and we lost pretty much 95% of the and that cost about $500,000. And New York Times, everybody loved it. It's a musical. It's totally good. But we couldn't make any money because we didn't have the cartel behind us.
Now, with the world the way it is now and so many different opportunities for independent distribution, do you see things changing a little bit from that? Because now an independent filmmaker who has an audience like these YouTubers, like these guys who are completely cutting out the cartel, as you call them, and creating a business on their own.
There's a big difference between Grumpy Cat and
of course,
and Angry Video Game Nerd and How To Basic, and I love them all. They're great, they're terrific, but that's not my beat. I make 90-minute movies.
You're right.
If you want to make a 90-minute movie, you've got to get in with one of the vassals of the big companies. Otherwise, you just don't have a chance in terms of making any money.
No,
I mean we have millions of people. I just came back from Portugal. We don't have a lick of distribution in Portugal. At the Portuguese Comic-Con in Porto. It's in Porto, Portugal. I swear it's the best Comic-Con I've ever been to. Beautifully organized. Mm-hmm. Absolutely top-notch. I was definitely not the big macher there.
Right.
But they had 1,000 people at my they told me 1,500 people were at my panel. It was Toxie and a crappy mask and me, and we have no distribution there. So we've got millions of people who are watching our movies through the magic of the internet. Unfortunately, we don't have any we don't have any revenue producing distribution.
Now, when you said Toxic, this is the way I was introduced to Troma and to you, as most people I think are, is through Toxic Avenger. I saw it back in the days when I was working in my video store in the late 80s.
Well, where many people saw me dance at the Manhole Club where I had a wonderful pole dancing act.
I would have. I'm sorry, I missed that one, sir.
Yeah, well, I just want to be sure that that I get credit for that part of my life.
Of course,
anyway, keep going.
No. So when I was at the video store working, and I saw this box of those VHS boxes, which were so beautiful, the artwork for Toxic Avenger, and I was like, "What is this?" And I took it home, and I was mesmerized by the. the audacity of it. And I was a young man at the time. I was still a teenager and I was just blown away by it. I was a big fan of it. And I'm like, wow, this is really cool. This is just cool. It's a warm place in my heart, Toxic Avenger. And I've always followed Troma and all the stuff you do since then. But how did you come up with the idea? And there's a story behind Toxic Avenger. And because you released it in the theaters, it was actually a hit, if I'm not mistaken. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, originally, first of all, all the movies that I get involved in with Mr. Michael Herz, my partner of 40 years, they all have political or sociological themes to them. And in the case of The Toxic Avenger, my wife and I used to go camping. And everywhere we went, this would be in the 70s, there was garbage. And it was non-biodegradable. We'd go in the wilderness. We'd go in the mountains. We'd go in the desert. And there were McDonald's cups or whatever. They weren't going to biodegrade.
Yeah.
And it got to me thinking, look, this is a terrible thing, the environment. By the way, this was well before Al Gore
Green Speed,
stole the Nobel Peace Prize and invented right. the internet.
yes, fat exactly.
Fuck, that fat fuck is in the front row at the peace conference in Paris, too. What obscenity is that? He did nothing. Obama's the one who stuck his neck out. Obama took shit. Obama said our biggest problem is a global warming, and everyone said no. Our biggest problem is terrorism. He's wrong. They are wrong. Obama was right. It is global warming.
All
it's
right.
because of global warming. You've got millions of people running out of they can't live. They've got to move, and they all moved into the cities of Syria, and that created all the crap that's going on. This is global warming. Obama's absolutely correct. At any rate, and Gore's taking credit for it.
So you were saying, Toxic Avenger actually, the seed of the idea of Toxic Avenger was because of all of the trash.
It started with the environment. But at the same time, Alex, there were an explosion of health clubs where body beautiful.
Right,
so
right.
Meanwhile,
yeah.
we are making ourselves beautiful in these sports clubs, not sports, you know, athletic workout clubs, you know, with the machines where you get
gyms,
gyms. Yeah, we're getting into athletic clubs and making body beautiful while we are defiling and destroying this big blue marble of ours.
Mm-hmm.
And it's yin and yang, as I referred. And I thought it'd be a good theme for a movie.
Mm-hmm.
Also, Michael Herz noticed that Variety or one of the house magazines of the studios, might have been Hollywood Reporter, it was one of them, one of the house organs, had a headline saying horror films are no longer viable commercially.
Mm-hmm.
So when the experts say something like that, we immediately do the opposite.
Of course.
So that we decided we wanted to switch from Squeeze Play Waitress, Stuck on You, The First Turn On, which all had political themes, by the way, or sociological themes. We wanted to switch into horror. And I couldn't – I like comedy, as does Michael, so we didn't want to make a – we wanted the monster to be a good guy. I love Frankenstein, and I always felt that, it's a pity that he, gets killed and destroyed. And so we wanted the monster to survive, and Chaplin is a big hero for me. So the blind girl is from City Lights and Preston Sturges. Mm-hmm. I was revisiting Preston Sturges at the time. And Sulliver's Travels was a big inspiration.
Oh, I love that movie. Love that movie.
Town of Tromaville and blah, blah. The book that my first book, All I Need to Know About Filmmaking, I learned from The Toxic Avenger.
Mm-hmm.
That my first book that I wrote, which was written by James Gunn. Has a huge section on. I can talk about Toxic Avenger and in fact, I've given master classes just on Toxic Avenger.
No,
because there's so much that actually all the movies I've done, they take a year or two to percolate, and then we write the script, and then another year or two to make, which is why my output is not exactly Alan Dwan.
Or Woody Allen, for that matter.
Yeah, Woody Allen. Yeah. Alan Dwan, I don't know if you remember him, but he was still around when I was at Yale, and he would make – he started in like 1912 and finished up around 19 – he made like 150 movies.
Now, I remember –
they were good. He was a good director.
Now, I remember when I first saw you, I think this is going back, God, like at least 10 to 12 years ago, when you were doing your tour for your book, you were mentioning
– Which book was it?
The Make Your Own Damn Movie.
Oh, okay, because I've written six books.
Yes, I know.
I've written six books that other people have written.
Exactly. But Make Your Own Damn Movie was the one that you were talking about, and you were in Florida at the time where I was.
Uh-huh.
And you were talking about Toxic Avenger, specifically about how – because at one point you had a cartoon series, you had toys, you had merchandise, and then you said it stopped because some – like the cartel or something was stopping you. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, we signed a deal with a New Line, a division of Turner, Warner, mm-hmm. whatever, Warner Brothers, mm-hmm. Time Warner, whatever. Mm-hmm. And they were going to make a big budget feature-length Toxic movie.
Right.
And we had the cartoons out. The toys were out. There were like 200 different licensed things, kids' sneakers and slippers and color forms and, mm-hmm. All that stuff. And the whole idea was the movie would be the locomotive to pull all this stuff along.
Mm-hmm.
And it turned out that New Line had their fingers crossed. They apparently were using Toxic Avenger as a stalking horse for the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, with whom they were having difficulty signing number three. And they kept us in their back pocket when they signed the third Turtles movie. Then they didn't even tell us they weren't going to make our movie. They kept us sort of spinning our wheels. And the only problem they had was their contract guaranteed that they would make a because we had other deals. Warner's wanted to make a Toxie movie,
mm-hmm.
a big budget, big budget movie, mainstream. The New Line in the contract says that they guaranteed to make the movie. It wasn't a pay and play or any of that crap. Mm-hmm. It was guaranteed to make. So they didn't do it, and that destroyed the whole thing, and everything went away. Everybody ran for the hills, and we had a nice, since we own everything, we had a little period there where we actually made a few bucks.
Oh, great!
And we sued New Line, and they those kind of companies do.
Mm-hmm.
They dragged it out for 3 or 4 years. They didn't think we had any money, but
right.
We did. We had really big time lawyers, and they settled on the steps of the courthouse, as they say. Yeah, as they say. And most independent producers have mortgaged their homes and don't have any money to hire top major white shoe lawyers. And we did. We had them because my father. Pulled some favors, and we had a major, major, major lawyer named Milton Gould, who actually ran Fox for a while.
Oh, wow. So you had some heavy guns.
After Daryl Zanuck and Cleopatra, Fox was in the shithouse, and Gould and the group were brought in to bail it out. And he and a big-time firm were our lawyers, and eventually New Line. And whenever I would see the boss of New Line, He always would say to me, he just couldn't. I guess we were the only ones that drew blood. He always would say, I mean, he was good natured about it.
Right.
He said, I gave you so much money, blah, blah, blah. Which he didn't. It wasn't that much.
Right, right.
But it must. We must have been the only ones because he always bemoaned that.
Well, it's the one
anyway,
that
it's a tough business. It's a hell of a business.
So now, like, you essentially, and I know you got over the years, you've become kind of the king of marketing yourself and Troma. And I know the first, I know a lot of people kind of knew you from the spectacle that you brought to the Cannes Film Festival. So can you talk a little bit about what you do there and what was your experience the first time you did it and how people reacted?
Well, first of all, let me say that there is a very nice movie on our movie channel.
Mm-hmm.
Troma's to
mm-hmm.
mark our 40th year and to show appreciation to our fans who've been there for 40 years and supporting us. We've given away at least 200 movies on YouTube.
Right.
Troma Movies on YouTube. It's our channel. If you go to Troma Movies, one of those films is called All the Love You Can, Cannes,
mm-hmm.
and it's a documentary about how Troma sells its movies at the Cannes Film Festival in the face of one billboard by Paramount costing more than a Troma movie at
right.
Cannes.
Right.
And we have to do street theater, we do parades, we have a legendary party. Anyway, All the Love You Can shows you this, and recently – thanks to the miracle of Kickstarter, our fans helped us get a sequel, a 10-year later sequel to that begun. And Charlotte Kaufman, our third mutant child, is currently editing it. And it should be really, really interesting. I think it's called Sincerely Tromaville or something like that.
Nice.
So your fans could look for that. I think it'll be finished. It's been – that's taken 2 or 3 years because we also have to feed – you know, the fans put up some of the money, but we've got to put the rest up, and we don't have very much. So she's been editing, and hopefully next year we'll have in fact, some film festivals have already contacted us about Sincerely Tromaville. They want to – seems that they want – you know, not horror festivals, but the other kind of festival. We've had a couple. I think somebody from Tribeca called over.
Oh, wow, cool.
So anyway, it should be interesting, for at least for the fans of filmmaking and do-it-yourself movie making. It does show how we distribute and how we – in fact, now it can. There are lots of – independent producers looking for distributors who go and create a kind of street theater, and they bring some sort of an animal like a llama to Cannes and do a parade, or they have crazy they kind of do what we've been doing for 30 some odd years.
But you were the first one to do it.
In my day, the first time I went was 1971. I mean, people have always done stunts at Cannes, but those stunts usually cost a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
We, you know, the Schwarzenegger gang, the Dependables.
Expendables.
The Depends wearing a bull, so whatever. they had a tank and an army with machine guns and all that kind of stuff. That's very expensive. So we do things in the street that create a huge amount of attention and mm-hmm. And the media, how many, you know, how many photo opportunities with women in $200,000 dresses can the media put up with?
When you have a Toxic Avenger walking the streets.
Yeah, exactly. Toxic Avenger with a mask that's all ripped up and somebody's vomited it in is actually a rather interesting story.
Now, you have obviously a rabid fan base that's been with you for years. Now, can you discuss the importance of audience building and how you interact with them?
Well, that's a great question, Alex. And we wouldn't be here without our fans. The fans and the internet are the two big reasons Troma still exists. We actually are a very small company. We have about 10 employees here.
Mm-hmm.
And but our fans do so much that it's as if we had a huge multinational corporation. We're making a movie in Portugal, and I went for Comic-Con because I was invited there. But a fan who his family gave us an apartment to live in for free, and I'd never met the guy. You know, knowing that our movie is very low budget, we started shooting Mutant Blast, mm-hmm. directed by Fernando Alle, who is another very talented young filmmaker who I've discovered. He made a movie we distribute called Banana Motherfucker, which is hilarious. He will be the next James Gunn or Trey Parker mm-hmm. or Eli, you know, the next Eli Roth. You know, a bunch of these guys have come up through Troma.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he's next in line. And anyway, he's directing Mutant Blast. We shot the first day while I was there. But fans paid for my an apartment right in the center of town, or they gave it to me. Their parents owned it or something. They go and take me to the airport. They pick us up. They feed us. And they also, all around the U.S., they go to the local movie theaters and they say, hey, Lloyd directed Return of Nukem High. We want to see it. Mm-hmm. And then we get a screening. We may only get, 1 week or 1 day or one mm-hmm. midnight showing.
Mm-hmm.
It's mainly calendar houses. But if I direct a movie, we get about 300 theaters, one by one by one by one by one. And in many cases, I have to go to the theater and create sort of an event and interact with the fans.
Of course.
But it's as if we have a big and people are on my Twitter. At LloydKaufman.com, a lot of fans think that we have this huge company, mm-hmm. and they say, why can't you show Return to Nukem High Volume 1 in Cincinnati, Ohio? I say, no problem. Go to the theater and get it booked.
Right.
They think we do all that stuff. It's the fans are really – we're a fan-propelled, fan-fueled fury, FFF.
Now, and can you – I think I heard you once talk about when to sell to your audience and when not to sell to the audience. And that's a mistake a lot of filmmakers and people who with audience do, that they just do that hard sell, like buy, 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 buy. And there's a moment when you can sell and there's a moment when you don't sell. How do you handle that?
Well, I think I interviewed Karen Black, who's a mm-hmm. she unfortunately died, but she was a big fan of and a good friend. And her thing was, I interviewed her for my distribution book, Distribute Your Own Damn Movie, mm-hmm. which I think is my best book.
Okay.
I think it's the most forward-looking visionary book. But I interviewed her just because she's a totally idealistic, wonderful person. And I thought her comments, even though she's not in the, you know, she's not a distributor, mm-hmm. she's an award-winning actress, having worked with everyone from Hitchcock to me. And she said that you should be honest. You shouldn't sell your movie with something it isn't. Mm-hmm. A perfect example.
You mean what Hollywood does on a daily basis is what you said.
Very often, the international companies. A perfect example is Observe and Report. That's a brilliant dark comedy with Seth Rogen. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, they sold it like Mall, like that fat, untalented
Mall Rats.
Actor. It was in
Mall Rats.
No, no, not Mall Rats. Mall Rats was great.
Yeah.
No, there was a one about a cop.
Paul Bart, Mall Cop. Yeah, Paul Bart.
Yeah, TV actor, Paul Bart. Oh, garbage. But they sold it. It was a big hit. And they made Observe and Report sound like that. They made a mistake. It was such a good movie. They should have just sold it as a great dark comedy. They would have done great with it. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful film. So that's a big mistake. I think the best way to sell is to be honest. And we, unfortunately, don't have a advertising budget. Mm-hmm. And we only get one theater now in New York. You know, in the days of Toxic Avenger – when it opened wide in New York, I think we had 70 theaters.
Oh, wow.
When Waitress, in 1980, Waitress, our movie Waitress, not to be confused with the one that's playing around now, mm-hmm. Waitress in 1980, 92 theaters just in New York City.
Wow.
So then you can advertise, you can spend money. But one theater, we can't spend any advertising money. So we have to get our fans to go out there and you know, we use my Twitter and the Troma website and Troma Facebook and we put a few ads in the New York Times or, you know, maybe on some of the internet sites. Mm-hmm. But it's all word of mouth. It's got to be word of mouth. And the young people today, they don't want to be, how many times do you want to see Travers, the critic, what's his name?
Oh, Peter Travers.
He likes every movie. He's on every movie poster. Right. You know, I don't think it means anything anymore. And I don't mean to single him out. But, you know, the New York Times critic, every movie. And the front page of the Sunday New York Times theater section, they twist themselves into a knot to try to feature and say good things about a movie just because it's opening, a big, big, big movie, you know. And, of course, they're on the needle of advertising, so they've got to pay attention to we had our 40th year in Troma last year or 2 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
It's a New York company. We've hired people who'd be on welfare if it weren't for us.
Mm-hmm.
We own a building. We pay real estate taxes. We've made movies. How many movies? You know, tons of movies in New York. Mm-hmm. Not one word in the New York Times. Not one word.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, when my book came out, or was it? No, when Poultry Guys came out, and we got good reviews, but they stick us in the ghetto. They do like a three paragraph review. You know, they put mm-hmm. They put me in with the Iranian guy who's making a politically correct movie about sheep fucking or something,
right.
You know, and it's his first movie.
Right.
You know, that's where they stick me. And God damn it. So we can't go that way. It's basically our fans. you know, we just have to let them know and ask them to please
spread
keep
the word.
Uncle Lloydie, keep Uncle Lloydie so he can afford to buy drugs and get drunk or whatever. And we've been fortunate.
And that's the Trauma Army. That's the Trauma Army.
Well, there's a perfect example. The Trauma Army is based in Cleveland, Ohio area. Mm-hmm. And they've been with us for 10 years. The couple who do our conventions, Ron and Kathy, Ron Mackey. Ron Mackey has a cameo, and he actually sings in Poultrygeist. Mm-hmm. We met him up there in Buffalo when we were making that movie. He and his wife have this huge group of fans, and they run our conventions east of the Mississippi. And they do about 30 horror, sci-fi, comic book conventions every year. Mm-hmm. They don't get paid. Every once in a while we try to pay them, but they don't even want it. Mm-hmm. They just do it because they love trauma. We've got a guy in Florida, Jimmy Wright, mm-hmm. who's a very talented musician, Architects of Fear. I made a music video for him for free to thank him. But he runs our Florida conventions, and he's in. They both are in our movies, of course. Mm-hmm. And then in California, we have a couple. Megan and Marcus, Megan Silver and Marcus.
No worries.
I took some cat tranquilizer this morning.
So basically, what you're telling
me is Marcus Lesser. They run our conventions in the West, and they all do this out of love for the fun of it, and out of love of trauma for the fun of it. Stan Lee got us the Toxic Avenger comic book done. I've been friends with him for 50 years. James Gunn has helped us. Eli Roth has helped us. A lot of the people who are now in the mainstream, mm-hmm. like the guy who greenlit Return to Nukem High Volume 1, mm-hmm. Was in a position of power at Stars, mm-hmm. he grew up with trauma, and they're all good people. And we've been really Tennessee Williams. We depend on the kindness of strangers.
Now, basically what you have is something that most independent filmmakers and independent film companies would kill for. You have a passionate, rabid audience that supports you and does work for you, essentially, for free. Because of the love of being associated with your brand or being a part of your brand.
There would be no, you know, Return to Nukem High is my Sistine Chapel. It's two movies. It's two halves. Mm-hmm. The first half has come out and played in theaters and been pretty well reviewed. The second half we are currently editing. We didn't have enough money to finish the second half. We ran out of money. Our fans put up the money to complete the post-production.
Now, I had the pleasure of speaking to a young lady on the show, Kansas Bowling. And she told me the story about how she went to your office and basically sold her movie to you guys. Can you tell me a little bit about it from your perspective?
Her movie wasn't finished, if I recall correctly. Mm-hmm. And I had lunch with her in L.A., and I was so impressed with her, I gave her money. I didn't ask for distribution rights. I didn't ask for anything. I took a check from the back of my checkbook so my wife wouldn't see it. And I gave her a pretty good amount of money. I think I'm executive producer of the movie. Uh-huh. I didn't. There were no strings attached. If she could have, I told her, you go to Paramount if you want. But she stayed with the Trauma. She gave it to Trauma to distribute.
That's
even
so
though it's very hard to make money. But I was very impressed with her because when I met her, she was 16 or something like that. And she was working on this movie.
Shot on 16.
Shot on 16 millimeter, which is pretty interesting, too, for anybody these days.
Right.
And it wasn't a zombie, you know, I get so many pitches and so many scripts and so many tweet people tweeting me, I've got the next Toxic Avenger. I don't need the next Toxic Avenger.
I've got Toxic Avenger.
Yeah, I can make my own crappy Toxic Avenger. I don't need another zombie movie. She's making her project was really – it was feminist. It was different. It was thank you. It was absolutely terrific, and she was terrific. I only had seen a little bit of the movie, and I didn't give the money for the movie. I gave it for Kansas Bowling because I was so impressed with her, and she was so she met at Los Angeles. I stay at a kind of a flea bag in Marina Del Rey, kind of. Mm-hmm. And there's a Mexican place. Oh, damn it. It's a well-known place. It's on the thing that goes to the water. It's right near the ocean.
Okay.
And, we met there. She took a bus to get there, and I was so impressed with her. And, you know, I hadn't even seen the movie, really. I saw a little bit of it, but...
And the movie's called B.C. Butcher, the first serial killer in prehistoric times?
Something like that. But it's a matriarchal movie. It's terrific.
Yeah.
And again, what an impressive... it's like a banana motherfucker. We're not going to make money with that movie. We're going to lose money. But we'll come out. You know, I don't know, we're not going to get killed. But that guy, Fernando, is a talented dude. And the next one, Mutant Blast, which we're financing, that will be his Cannibal the Musical. That'll propel him.
Right.
And that, I hope, will make a few bucks. But I think that'll propel him the way that Romeo and Juliet got James Gunn's motor running and got him propelled. And I think this movie, B.C. Butcher, will be a first step for Kansas Bowling, for sure. She's motivated. She's talented.
She's amazing. Amazing.
Yeah, she's pretty amazing. Right?
She actually reached out to us, even not knowing that I was going to have you on the show. And she just reached out to us. It's like, I love what you're doing. This is my story. I'm like, oh, I have to have you on. Because how often do you get a 17-year-old who's shooting a 16-millimeter feature film today?
I don't get is that she lives in California. Where are the all these wonderful studio people who are so puff themselves up at the Kennedy Center or puff themselves up on these award shows, you know, the Spirit Awards and all that shit? Where were they when she was coming along? Same with Cannibal the Musical. The mm-hmm. only person that gave Trey and Matt any kind of encouragement mm-hmm. was Stan Brakhage, the experimental filmmaker, who was a big hero to me, mm-hmm. who was in the movie, mm-hmm. and Troma.
Right?
And now when you talk to people out in L.A., you talk to the suits, I love that film. I wanted to distribute blah, 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 blah.
And they never did.
Yeah, but meanwhile, it's Troma who – Right.
Now, can you give a list? Talk about a handful of the people who've actually come up through Troma who are now big time actors or directors?
Well, we were the first to recognize the great talents of Sir Ron Jeremy.
Jeremy, I love
him. We put him in. He plays the mayor of Tromaville back in 1985 in mm-hmm. Class of Newcomb High Part 2 and 3.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, Samuel Jackson's first movie, I didn't direct it, so it's good. His first movie is Death by Temptation.
Oh, yeah. I remember that movie.
And all black, we were, Michael Herz and I were the only white people involved in that movie.
Mm-hmm.
All we did was give him money. And it's a wonderful film, but it wouldn't have gotten made if we didn't step in and give him about $400,000, as I recall. And mm-hmm. we distributed it. And it did very well in the theaters, but then the video stores
blew up.
They were afraid that the black
people
come in and burn their stores down.
We had it in our little video store in Florida. So,
well, good for you. You were brave. The Boys from the Hood came out, which was Columbia Pictures, as I recall,
mm-hmm. 1990, right.
And the stores were not burnt down. I think that opened up a lot. But we unfortunately did not make money. I think Death by Temptation may be our best film. But I think Samuel Jackson ought to give us a little
Of that Marvel money.
give us at least a mention every once in a while, because that movie wouldn't have happened without us.
Got it. So who else?
White people. Nobody was financing, as I recall. Nobody was financing old black movies then. If they were, it was Spike Lee, and that's it.
Now, you talk
maybe
about Matt
and Trey. And Andy in the 50s, but it wasn't much.
Now, Matt and Trey.
There because Michael Herz liked that film. Michael Herz said, this is a good film. And it wasn't a stereotypical movie. It wasn't.
Right. No, it definitely is not.
Bobby Brown beat up the women kind of movie.
No.
It's a really wonderful. It didn't matter what color the people are in Death by Temptation. It's funny. It's scary. It's colorful. It's beautifully shot. And I was scared shit because I had to shoot the big climactic monster blowing up scene, and I had to follow the guy who directed Juice and
Yeah. I know who you're talking about. I forgot his name.
I had to follow his camera, and I was worried that he would be furious because I DP'd the end of the movie. Oh, damn it. I've interviewed him, too. He's in my book. He's the best. He did Juice, but he's a great cameraman. I got a DP.
So then you also you also launched Matt and Trey of South Park fame.
How nice are they? They acted in Terra Firma, a movie that I directed, which is my most personal film, Terra Firma. And I urge anyone who's interested in filmmaking to see it because it's about making a trauma movie. They play hermaphrodite couple.
Yes.
And they did it right after they were on the cover of Newsweek or something. And I can imagine their agents and managers were delighted that
I'm sure they were. But
those roles with no pay, no less.
But they walked. They definitely danced to their own beat, those two.
Oh, they're great.
And they're awesome.
There are people in the mainstream who are amazing. James Gunn is the best. Guardians of the Galaxy recently.
Which, by the way, I love your cameo in Guardians of the Galaxy.
Well, thank you.
I actually saw it. I was like, there's Lloyd when I was sitting in the theater.
Well, thank you. I'm most happy about that. And you're not alone in that one. I got more
fan mail.
What do you call it? Kudos. What's the other word?
Props.
I got more props for those 2 seconds than anything I've done in 50 years of making movies. Thank you, James Gunn.
Oh no!
Seriously, that was
when you're in a
Eli
movie
Roth.
Like that.
Eli Roth does the commentary track for Bloodsucking Freaks.
Mm-hmm.
It's terrific. If you get the DVD, or I think we may have just put out the Blu-ray. He loves movies. He he's the best.
Right.
A great guy, a wonderful guy, and he's always trying to help us. Guillermo del Toro had nothing to do with making movies with him, but he also wonderful guy, loves trauma. Talks about us, tries to get our name out there, you know.
I've spoken to great people
in the mainstream.
Guillermo's awesome. He loves filmmakers. I've met him a few times, and he's been amazing. So, where do you see trauma in 10 years?
I think trauma and Toxie have a life of their own, but it's a tough, very tough. We own a big library of movies.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully it's not, you know, I'm going to be 70 years old in 2 weeks. I could make a noise like a frog at any moment. Michael Herz is getting on too, although he looks great and he seems as strong as Superman.
Right.
I think the best would be to hopefully whoever moves in keeps it as as an entity, it's got its own life and its own
energy,
joy,
everything.
Its own joy and soul. And Sam Arkoff, he created American International Pictures, out of whose loins everybody, including Roger Corman, out of whose loins everybody else. I mean, I'm an amateur. I've stayed in New York in the underground. So a lot of the people who I've worked with are New York underground, you know, they have not become James Gunn. Although they're extremely talented and they're doing great, they are not household words the way Jack Nicholson from Corman and Coppola, everybody came out of Corman and AIP. But Sam Arkoff loved Troma, and we were good buddies. And he told me his biggest regret was that he sold his company to what was then called Filmways, I think it was. And that they eventually became Viacom. And, of course, all those movies and that wonderful spirit that was AIP is, of course, all dissolved into,
Yeah, I got
we
you.
We are such stuff as dreams are made of, and our little life is rounded with a sleep. It's all dissolved into nothingness, unfortunately.
It happens.
And the AIP, American International Pictures, had such a great – I mean, my company was basically modeled on that business model, except I'm crazier and not terribly commercially minded. but that was the company that proved to me when I was at Yale, when I saw Roger Corman's Man with the X-ray Eyes and Crab Invasion of the Crab Monsters and the Poe movies. Edgar Allan Poe, not the little rock and roll guy.
Mm-hmm.
Not that Poe. nor the River Poe. When I saw Corman's movies, it proved to me that, gee, you can make good low-budget movies with good scripts and good acting and make them worthwhile and have a personal have your personal statement involved too.
Now,
so they're very important.
Now, do you have any advice for young filmmakers trying to break into the business today?
Good question. I think you've got to make a choice.
Okay.
I think if you want the Oscars and the hookers and the mansion and the cocaine and all that,
mm-hmm.
You've got to go out to L.A. if you want to make a lot of money. I don't mean go out to L.A., but you've got to become a partner with one of the vassals of Rupert Murdoch
mm-hmm.
or such.
Mm-hmm.
Or you do what I did and do what you believe in and scrape a few bucks together and make a movie that is totally your own. And if it does well, great. And if it doesn't, you keep going, you keep trucking and full steam ahead. I think Shakespeare said it best. He's the guy who coined that phrase, to thine own self be true.
Mm-hmm.
He did that. He wrote a bestseller called 101 Money-Making Screenplay Ideas, otherwise known as Hamlet.
You're right.
I think he had the right idea, to thine own self be true. Do what you believe in, because this is the hardest.
There's
nothing harder than making movies. And James Gunn made a speech when I was on the set of Guardians of the Galaxy. You know, even though it's a $200 million movie, he made a speech about when he's on set, he's channeling Uncle Lloydie because he wants to be responsible. He wants to be on schedule. He wants to have total freedom, and he does. And he wants to make the best movie he can. But at the same time, he wants to be responsible because, we all know about Heaven's Gate. We've read that fascinating book
by Bach,
is his name, right? The Final Cut.
Right,
wonderful.
Yeah.
I read it one night. It's fascinating.
I have to understand.
You don't want to do that. You don't want to go that way.
No, I can imagine the immense amount of pressure on like a J.J. Abrams now with Star Wars coming out soon and James with Guardians. And Guardians was a complete, like, nobody knew. A lot of people thought it was going to fail and nobody knew it. It was an unproven property. I can only imagine the kind of pressure a director is under. Because if he does a misstep, it's gone. It's over. The game's done.
It's more when you're making a movie for $500,000 because you have to be responsible for everything from mm-hmm. the bathrooms to the,
right.
You don't have enough bathrooms, a lot of trouble. And there's nobody in between you and the bathroom guy, right?
Right.
Right. We had a thing on Citizen Toxie, the Toxic Avenger Part 4, where we didn't have enough of those porta potties. And they filled up. So when you sat down on them, you felt the person who defecated leavings on your behind. You know, I mean, that's a horrible thing. But I'm at the top there. I've got to be responsible for the lunches. And are they going to be on time? Where are the cars going to park? I don't want them in the shot. You know, we're working in large part with the very idealistic young people who come from all over the world.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the guy who came in from Iceland. I can't put him in charge of location scouting, right? The guy who worked
right.
on for Return to Nukemai Volume 1.
All right.
By the way, he Bjarni Gauter is his name. He knows more about trauma movies than anybody in the world. But I can't, you know, in other words, there's huge amount of pressure. It's a very dangerous, you know, we have explosions, car crashes,
right.
Special effects where people have to transform chemicals, latex. Silicone,
all sorts of stuff.
It's very dangerous, and people are working 20 hours a day, and they're sleeping on the floor and eating crap food and learning how to defecate in a paper bag, and it's very stressful. On the other hand, it's the greatest occupation in the world.
Right, exactly. After all of that, but it's the greatest thing I've ever done.
I wish I had a little more money to take the pressure off because it really is tough. And the other problem, of course, is that insurance is huge for movies because it's all based on the big boys.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're a $500,000 movie and insurance ends up at a huge percentage of the budget. It's mm-hmm. crazy.
Now,
but we can't possibly not have it.
Oh, of course not. No, if not.
Right? Debbie Rochon, queen of independent movies, a wonderful actress, had her hand literally cut off on a low-budget movie down south somewhere with a bayonet, and they didn't have insurance, and she was totally screwed.
Oh, jeez.
Right? It's horrible. No way that can happen. You know, we're not, we have to have insurance. And the everything is aimed at the big guys.
Of
very
course.
Little. It's all the playing field is used to be slightly. You know, maybe it would be at a 45-degree angle against you, the independent filmmaker. Now it's literally like a stripper's pole, and it's greased, so you can't climb up it. I mean, it's very hard. You really have to want to be
a filmmaker.
Very, very independent, or you've got to go join the mainstream and try to do what Trey and Matt and James Gunn and Eli Roth and others have done. You know, not many of them, but there are great, 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 wonderful people who are making great movies in the mainstream. And there's some great actors. I mean, you have to assume that Kristen Wiig, I've never met her. I met her once. I met her once because my wife is the New York State Film Commissioner.
Right.
But I, you know, we had the two words. But she's doing good movies. You know, she's doing great stuff. There's a whole generation of mainstream actors and directors. Adam McKay, I'm going to run to see The Big Short.
Oh, I'm dying to see that.
Great because he's a great director and writer. And Eastbound and Down is terrific. So there are great people in the mainstream. And again, I don't know a lot of them, but the ones I do know, like the ones I've mentioned, they're wonderful people. They're great, lovely people.
Now, what is the lesson that took you the longest to learn in life or in the film business?
Oh, continuing what I just said, I think that I clearly don't have the ability to navigate the corridors of power the way James and Eli and those guys and Trey and Matt can do. And it may be that my vision and my soul and my talent just simply aren't there or don't conform to what the public, what the mainstream public is interested in. So I probably that's the lesson that took a while to sink in, because for the first 15 or 20 years of trauma, we did try to at least we did try.
To break through that, yeah.
To work with the mainstream. You know, we went on a lot of goose chases because they, you know, they hear, like, I remember with Stuck on You, the woman from Warner Brothers, I had to go out there and bring the stupid movie with me when it was finished. And at one point she started crying because we didn't want to do it. We knew that the woman was there to say no. That was why she was there. So I put on my bar mitzvah suit. I take the print out there, 35 millimeter. I go to the studio. They don't have my parking pass. It's a 5,000-degree day, too. The sun is beating down. I'm sweating like a pig. I've got the two cans with me. I can't. So I get a park. Finally, I get a parking space. It's a half a mile from the screening room or whatever. And, and then they say, well, you can leave the print here. Well, wait a minute. I'm not supposed to meet with the what? Blah, blah, blah. No. And, of course, they have no intent. They just want to say no. So eventually we gave up. You know, we just realized this is not, you know, it's just not for us. And then finally, the coup de grace was the final countdown where Kirk Douglas and Peter Douglas, because of our ability to produce movies that look big for very little money, they brought me on to the final countdown. And I was associate producer. We had a little piece of the action. We never saw a cent, of course. United Artists distributed it. But that movie could have been great. Kirk Douglas is a hero, a great film director, a great actor, a great writer, you know, a genius. His son, Peter, same thing. And I, we were the only ones who wanted to make a good movie. Nobody else gave a shit. They all were concerned about who had a bigger suite than Jimmy Tarantino or whatever. One of them were upset with me. Because, Peter was 19 and I was 30-something. And was I 30? 45? Yeah, I was 30-something, low 30s. He was upset because Kirk had a bigger corner suite than he did. The special effects guy, practical effects guy, was glomming false. He was putting in false petty cash. I mean, what were we going to have for lunch? They didn't like the lunch. They didn't.
Got it. It was not about the movie.
The director was a drunk. The, absurd. And, Here's a movie with Martin Sheen, Catherine Ross, and a bunch of Kirk Douglas. And but it was made for very little money compared to what it could have been made for. And it has the director didn't want to use the we wanted to have F-14s dogfighting with Japanese Zeros. It's terrific, way ahead of war games or video games or anything. Mm-hmm. And the director said, no, we can use that's a hugger-mugger or something. He had some word he used that he thought was cute. Hugger-mugger, hugger-mugger. He used file footage. You know, and luckily Kirk wouldn't stand for it. And Peter and I got the Navy to agree to use the – you know, we were able to actually have the F-14s and the Zeros. But if you look at that film and you imagine – what would that be? That'd be like Rocky without Stallone jumping up the stairs, running up the stairs.
Right, you know? of course.
But in the case of Rocky, which I worked on, there was a dedicated group there, an enlightened group. In the case of Final Countdown, that could have been a fabulous movie. It's not bad.
Right.
It could have been so good. Kirk and Peter were the only ones who gave, and me. Other than that, it was like we're pulling along a giant barge of garbage, you know, so, by ourselves.
So, this. I
by the
this
way, if you want to see me vent, there's a Blu-ray of Final Countdown put out by Blue Underground.
Yeah,
in which they interviewed me, and I pretty much I talk about it in much more detail. I think I tell the truth. And by the way, if you get the Rocky Fox put out a multi. I think all the Rocky movies in a box set, and the big thing they're publicizing is my home movies, because the guy who works for us was down in the building, the Troma building basement, and found all this Super 8 stuff. I must have shot – I don't remember it, but I shot a lot of behind-the-scenes stuff in Super 8, and I sent it out to John Avildsen, the director, and he chopped it down, and he and I wrote a script for it, and there's about a 10-minute piece where you actually see how we shot – all these great scenes in Philadelphia.
Oh,
I was a line producer or production manager on the they used a non-union crew from Cry Uncle. They didn't have enough money to film in Philadelphia and bring everybody there, but Stallone and Avildsen wanted Philadelphia, and right they were. So Avildsen had me put together the Cry Uncle gang that he used, non-union guys, and we shot about 8 days. Iconic shots of Stallone running through the fruit market and going up the steps and pet store and all that stuff. We did Sub Rosa, and I was in charge of all that. And when he the Steadicam, first time the Steadicam was used,
right?
First time, and I have behind the scenes footage. I couldn't believe it, just because one of the guy who works for us, Matt Mangiarides, would whenever he had free time, he'd go down to the basement of our building and rummage around down there, and he came up with these home movies. I had no recollection of shooting them, except that my wife is in them about every 2 seconds. So then I saw the camera store. I filmed a little bit of end of the reel in the camera store that I used to get the stuff processed. So it had to be mine.
So this is a question I ask all my guests. What is your top three films of all time? I'm dying to hear your answer.
I don't have top. I can tell you.
Just three movies you love.
I can tell you the number one movie.
Okay. Okay.
The Religious Experience. And I've only seen this movie once because it was such a religious experience. And I didn't want to sully that experience, although I probably should. I'll be dead soon. I'd be kind of curious to see what I think of it now. Mizoguchi, the Japanese John Ford, or John Ford was the American Mizoguchi. He made a movie called Princess Yang Guifei. And it's a Chinese legend, Chinese novel, part of a Chinese novel from the Middle Ages. And it's if you look up the word sublime in the dictionary, you will find Princess Yang Guifei. And that movie was just such a experience for me, cosmic, that I didn't want to see it again. I never wanted to see it again. In fact, she gave me a plexiglass box with a lock, and she locked up the VHS inside the plexiglass box and gave me a key to open it. And it says open for if desperate or open in emergency or something like that. I have it, but I didn't use it. Princess Yang Guifei. So that To me, probably that's the number one movie of all time. But I think I go by directors, as I mentioned. I think anything by Chaplin, by John Ford, by Keaton, Buster Keaton.
Keaton, I love Keaton.
Howard Hawks, Jean Renoir, Fritz Lang, Stan Brakhage, the greatest visual artist of my lifetime, probably. I think those kinds of
cover
Fritz Lang, Leni Riefenstahl. You know, I couldn't really tell you
a movie.
Preston Sturges. I love his book, Preston Sturges. I read it a long time ago. Between the Flops.
That's a great name for a book.
There's a cautionary tale. The guy was the Oliver Stone of his day, and that he had hit after, you know, major, major man. And the suits still wouldn't leave him alone. They destroyed him. They made him, Buster Keaton also. And the lesson, the takeaway there is own your negatives. Do what Chaplin did. Chaplin owned his negatives. He was hounded. He was blacklisted. He had to flee the United States. We treated him like shit, but he owned the negatives. So he ended up a rich man. Buster Keaton, equally as talented, and maybe more so, was unfortunately a contract player, a contract director, and his career was ruined by the.
He died broke, if I'm not mistaken.
Sure, he did. He was destroyed, and it's more than money. It's you know, they break you down, they turn you to drink. Horrible. And I've been lucky. You know, I just came from I go to San Diego Comic-Con, and in terms of celebrity, I get a line of people who want my autograph, right? I go out in the street, and people, get out of my way, old man. Get out of, you know, they're yelling at me. So I kind of have a little bit of celebrity in a certain way. It's pretty interesting. But yet I don't have the – it's not like Taylor Swift or somebody where
walking the street, right.
Yeah, although my breasts as I get older.
Lloyd, you are the definition of a hustler, an indie film hustler, without question. You are the granddad, uncle of hustling. And
well, that's why you should see Terra Firma if you haven't. If anybody out there, because Larry Benjamin, he's a blind director. I play the part. Uh-huh. And, you know, maybe his films are good, maybe they're not. But he believes in them. He believes in them, and he's hustling. He can't even see. and as a result, whatever it is, he attracts a following. And I think that's a lot to be said there. And by the way, that was Terra Firma was shot before Woody Allen did his blind director movie.
Right, that one with
Hollywood Ending.
Yeah.
Although Hollywood Ending is – I love Hollywood Ending.
It's a great film.
I love that film. It was not – people didn't like it, but I loved it.
So, Lloyd, where can people find you?
On Twitter. I answer all my own Twitter.
Okay.
So that's the best way, at Lloyd – double L-O-Y-D, by the way, not L-Y-O-D or L-O-X-Q-P. L-L-O-Y-D, Kaufman, K-A-U-F-M-A-N. It's unbelievable how many people misspell the word Lloyd.
So
by the way, Lloyd is a Welsh name, and it's pronounced the double L is pronounced in Welsh.
So you've got your Twitter? What else? Facebook?
Yeah, that's the best way to contact me. But the Troma website, you can contact.
Is that troma.com?
Troma, TROMA.com. There's a Troma Facebook, my Facebook. I've got a Tumblr and
YouTube.
I'm on Instagram.
What's your YouTube?
Troma's YouTube. And as I say, every day we put up a new movie or short film or Uncle Lloydie's diary. I do a little video diary. And we have Make Your Own Damn Movie educational videos, how we raise money, how we squash a head using a everyday around the house melon. How we sell our movies, short pieces from my master classes or videos of pieces of my books. Every day we put up something new. Troma Movies, and it's YouTube. Troma Movies. We've got 120,000 subscribers.
Nice.
So it's very good. It's all free. Got nothing to lose.
Lloyd, thank you again. I mean, it's been an absolutely entertaining by far and educational interview. So thank you so much for taking out the time, man. I really appreciate it.
I love to hear from people who are fans of movies and even those who are opposed to what we're doing. I answer everything. So contact me on Twitter is probably the best way. And thank you so much. I really appreciate your interest, Alex, and keep up the good work with Indie Film Hustle.
I want to thank Lloyd for coming on the show and just being an inspiration to filmmakers, filmtrepreneurs, and any filmmaker out there who wants to make personal films, films that they feel proud of no matter what the topic might be. Now, not everybody loves Lloyd's movies, but I am so glad that he gets to make them in today's world. So if you want to get more information about Troma Films and Lloyd and to study his business model, head over to filmtrepreneur.com/017 for the show notes. And if you haven't already, please head over to filmbizpodcast.com, subscribe, and leave a good review for the show. It really helps us out a lot. And also an update on the Rise of the Filmtrepreneur book. That is going to be coming out early November. We have a slated date of November 7th. The book has been written. I am working on the audiobook as we speak. And my book editor is getting everything ready. So we should hopefully have it out by early November. And I promise you, it is going to blow your mind. It is a fairly epic, epic book. If you want to do a pre-order on that right now and get it early, head over to filmbizbook.com. That's filmbizbook.com. Thank you for listening. I hope this was of value to you on your filmtrepreneur journey. As always, the power is in your hands. Be a filmtrepreneur. I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to the Indie Film Hustle podcast at indiefilmhustle.com. That's INDIEFILMHUSTLE.com.